Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LPFM 106.1 Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, here to introduce our show to you. It's December 17th, 2005. Today we focus on responding with conscience to the military and imprisonment. Here's what we have coming up for you. A talk by Camilo Mejia, GI resistor, conscientious objector, and Iraq War veteran for peace, given in Lawrence, Mass. On December 7, 2005. We then have an interview by Tom Jackson of one of the Catholic workers who went to Cuba to march to Guantanamo Bay in protest of the treatment of the prisoners there. Plus, we have music, people's history, and Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. First, for some news. We begin the news with a statement from Amnesty International in the UK. Execution of Stanley Williams, a travesty of justice. Amnesty International has condemned the execution of Stanley Williams in California after Mr. Williams was lethally injected on death row. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger had been asked to grant clemency in the case, but declined to do so. Former gang leader Stanley Williams was sentenced to death in 1981 for four murders carried out in 1979. While on death row, Stanley Williams completely transformed himself, repudiating his past acts and violent lifestyle, and dedicating himself to educating young people about the dangers of gang life. Amnesty International UK Director Kate Allen said, "This is yet another sad milestone in the history of U.S. justice." Williams' violent past was well known, but he had become a textbook version of rehabilitation, and his execution was a travesty of justice. Williams, one of the founders of the notorious Crips Street Gang in Los Angeles, California in the early 1970s, underwent what he described as a redemptive transition in prison, renouncing gang life and working to educate young people. He wrote a series of children's books about the dangers of gang life, was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize on several occasions, and in 2005 received a U.S. Presidential Service Award from the President's Council on Service and Civic Participation. Williams had also always maintained his innocence of the crimes for which he was executed. According to his clemency petition, the case against him rested on testimony from accomplices in the crime and informants who were facing imprisonment or the death penalty for various offenses, but who all received reduced sentences or freedom in exchange for their testimony. There were also concerns about racial discrimination within the trial process itself. Williams was tried in an area where only 1% of the jury pool was black. The trial prosecutor removed all African Americans from the jury, and on one occasion compared Williams, who sometimes appeared in court in shackles, to a Bengal tiger. In January 2005, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger announced plans to remodel the focus of the prison system away from punishment towards rehabilitation. In its 2004 ruling, the California Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal said that Stanley Williams' good works and accomplishments since incarceration may make him worthy of an act of executive clemency. This next article, entitled Incalculable Pain, appeared in Salon.com on December 12th. A group of seven House Democrats wrote President Bush this week accusing the Pentagon of underreporting casualties in Iraq. The letter writers argue that Pentagon casualty reports show only a sliver of the injuries, mostly physical ones from bombs or bullets. But war doesn't work like that, the Democrats declare, adding that the reports skip accidents, illness, disease, and mental trauma. The group wrote Bush on December 7th. "We are concerned that the figures released to the public by your administration do not accurately represent the true toll that this war has taken on the American people." Pentagon casualty reports show 2,390 service members dead from Iraq and Afghanistan and over 16,000 wounded. By far, the vast majority of the wounded and dead are from Iraq. But by December 8, 2005, the military had evacuated another 25,289 service members from Iraq and Afghanistan for injuries or illnesses not caused directly by enemy bullets or bombs, according to the U.S. Transportation Command. That statistic includes everything from serious injuries in Humvee wrecks or other accidents to more routine illnesses that could be unrelated to field battles. Yet those service members are not included in the Pentagon's casualty reports. Neglecting these kinds of casualties does not appear to be an invention of the Bush administration. Pentagon casualty reports from previous wars, including Vietnam, list the number of dead and wounded and also appear to exclude non-combat injuries and illnesses. In their letter to Bush, the Democrats cite a November 2004 60 Minutes segment which featured badly injured soldiers who were upset by their being excluded from the official count, even though they were, in one soldier's words, in hostile territory. An October VA report shows that 119,247 service members who fought in Iraq or Afghanistan and are now off duty are receiving health care from the VA. Presumably, some of those health problems are unrelated to the war. But the statistics seem to show that a lot of those health problems are war-related. For example, nearly 37,000 have mental disorders, including nearly 16,000 who have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. Over 46,000 veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan receiving benefits from the VA have musculoskeletal problems. These are all veterans who, within the last 4 years, were considered by the military to be mentally and physically fit enough to fight. In their letter, the seven Democrats assert that the entire picture of casualties coming out of the Department of Defense is distorted. But the letter concludes that one thing is clear. What we can be certain of is that at least tens of thousands of young men and women have been physically or psychologically damaged for life. From the Associated Press on December 8th, Iraq casualty sign will stay up near Duluth recruiting office. The Steve Kelly for Governor campaign office in Duluth says it won't take down a sign in its window that keeps a running tally of U.S. casualties in Iraq. The sign has stirred up some hard feelings because it's right next door to the military recruiting station in downtown Duluth. The commander of the station says the sign is troubling for some of his recruiters, including one who recently returned from Iraq. He says his recruiters already have enough to endure the anti-war protesters who gather outside the office every Monday. But a Kelly campaign spokeswoman says the sign will stay up. It was put up by a campaign volunteer who was wounded in the Vietnam War and says he regrets not speaking out against it then. Kelly is a Democrat slash farmer slash labor state senator from Hopkins. Also from the Associated Press, on December 11th, thousands protest against WTO in Hong Kong. Anti-globalization activists marched on Sunday in the first mass protest against the World Trade Organization's summit in Hong Kong. The 149-member WTO, which set rules for global commerce, is a champion of free trade, which it says brings global economic prosperity. But many protesters say globalization favors the rich and robs workers of their jobs. The demonstrators, who have been flooding into Hong Kong from around the world ahead of the meeting on December 13th through 18th, marched from Hong Kong's downtown Victoria Park to the government's main office. They chanted, "Junk WTO! Our world is not for sale." Police have been busy securing neighborhoods around the meeting venue, putting up mesh on buildings and blocking off streets. Members of the militant Korean Peasants League held up a banner that said, "This hamburger is made of people's meat. Can you enjoy it?" The sign showed a hamburger made of hands and feet. The group opposes further opening South Korea's market to agricultural imports. British activist Tom Grundy was dressed like a chicken and held a sign that said, "WTO, more dangerous than chicken flu." He said, "We need to raise awareness of the true intention of the WTO. It's undemocratically elected. It undermines and overrides any law a country wants to bring to protect workers and the environment. Activists with the Indonesian Migrants Workers Union were carrying a giant red and brown spider with a monster's head, which they said symbolized the WTO. They chanted, "Sink WTO now." One Hong Kong protester posed as a slave master with a whip, while another wore a pig's mask to portray an exploitative employer. Another group wheeled along life-size statues of emaciated people, trying to make the point that farm subsidies in wealthy countries contribute to world hunger by keeping poor nations from selling their farm goods, according to a leaflet from a group that called itself the Danish Association for International Cooperation. Members of the Indian farmers group Tamil Nadu Dalit Women's Movement chanted, "WTO out of agriculture." The group spokeswoman, Fatima Bernard, said that opening India's market to imports would be devastating for farmers. "We don't want the WTO to reach any agreement on agriculture. It's spoiling our industry," she said. Protesters also came from India, Pakistan, Japan, Thailand, the United States, and South Africa to oppose the lowering of trade barriers. Carla Coletti, a spokeswoman of the Geneva-based International Metal Workers Union, which represents 25 million workers in 100 countries, said, "It's going to destroy jobs and increase the gap between the rich and poor countries and the rich and poor people in a country." 2 months ago, WTO Chief Pascal Lamy acknowledged in a speech in Hong Kong that free trade hurts some people, particularly those in poorer nations. But he said those who benefit are in the majority. That's our news for now. And now we go to Kate Wolfe with Brother Warrior.
Gentle warrior, with your heart like gold and a rainbow in your eyes. Brave companion, do you see a world shining in the sky? With your body dancing like an arrow, spreading joy beneath your feet and your hands, the wave like tall grass in the wind as you speak. With the shyness of a small child and the wisdom of a sage, I tell you now, there is no reason to be afraid. Brother warrior, there are none of us who walk this path alone. Spirit healer, it's the only life that we have ever known. I see your smile in the sunlight. I hear your song in the rain. And I hold you here inside me. Feel your love, know your pain. At this time when the earth is waking to the dawn of another age, I tell you now, there is no reason to be afraid. Thank you. are crying for a vision that all living things can share, and those who care are with us everywhere.
That was Kate Wolfe with Brother Warrior. We now bring you a talk by Camilo Mejia, GI resistor, conscientious objector, and Iraq War veteran for peace. He spoke on December 7, 2005 in Lawrence, Mass. His talk was sponsored by the Merrimack Valley People for Peace and taped by Damon Thomas.
Welcome. My name is Becky Bachman. I'm the Vice President of MVPP. 45% of the Iraqis now believe they are morally justified in shooting at American soldiers in Iraq. This poll was commissioned by the British, and that's the situation our kids find themselves in once they are in the military and once they are shipped out to Iraq. Again, and this past Friday night, I don't know if many of you saw the program, but Nightline brought in a bunch of Iraqi citizens and asked them whether or not they wanted American soldiers to be in Iraq. There were at least 10 people in the room from all walks of life. Only one person said, "I think the American soldiers need to be here." The other nine said, "What you don't appreciate is that we're educated. We actually had an infrastructure. We have a culture that is much older than the United States. We have a culture that's thousands of years old. And we have the ability to put our own country back together. You people are occupying our country." So it's time for us as citizens in this country to deal realistically with the fact that 45% of the Iraqi population feel they have the moral right to shoot at any soldier who is in their country. And I dare say that if we had an occupying force in this country, most of our citizens would feel exactly the same way. So, we have with us tonight a young man who has served in Iraq, and he decided that it was not morally within him to go back and to continue to kill Iraqis, because what we wanted to do was get rid of one man, and what we did instead was invade an entire country. It took a lot of courage for Camilo to spend time in prison instead of pointing a gun at and killing Iraqi citizens. But we are very, very pleased tonight to have Camilo here and to have him talking about the realities of what it is to be in the military. Please join me in warmly welcoming Camilo Mejia.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. I'd like to talk about how I came to join the military. This was back in 1995 when I was 19 years of age. I had just graduated from high school. I had been going to school at night and going to work in the daytime at a Burger King. It was a new situation for me because I had been traveling a lot. And I found myself without a sense of belonging, without a sense of community, with no benefits, and having to work and to live paycheck to paycheck to make a living. At the time I graduated from high school, I started attending a community college in Miami called Miami-Dade Community College, which is, of course, a public community college. And I was receiving financial aid from the government to attend this community college while I was working at Burger King earning minimum wage. After two semesters of attending this community college, the government decided that I made enough money to to pay for my own tuition. So they withdrew my financial aid. So at this time, when I find myself wanting to go to college but not having the means to go to college, with no medical insurance, with no dental insurance, with no stable financial situation, I felt like I needed a radical change in my life. And this is when I was enlisted in the military. When I spoke with the recruiter told me that you would be going into the military for 3 years. You will be an infantryman. You will be the cream of the crop. You will be the best trained. You can go to Ranger school. You can jump out of airplanes. You'll be the envy of your peers because you'll be an infantryman. And most likely what you'll be doing, you'll be sleeping in the back of a truck. You won't be going to war. So I joined the military, and for the most part, I had a really great experience while I was in, I have to be honest. I was an infantryman, I wasn't really concerned with politics, it was a peaceful time back then. I completed my basic training in Fort Benning, Georgia, which is the home of the infantry in the US military, the US Army. And then from there, I went to Fort Hood, Texas, and I was stationed with the 4th Infantry Division. For 3 years, I did my active duty time. It was actually 3.5 years because I signed up through the delayed entry program. And when I got out of the military, I was approached by a National Guard recruiter who told me every military contract that you sign is actually 8 years. So whether you get out of the military, you get out of the, you go home, you're still in the military, you're subject to be called for a total of 8 years. So if you did 3.5, you still have 4.5 years where the military can call you back to serve within the military. So if you join the National Guard, you are in the military anyway. But if you join the National Guard, we'll pay for your tuition. So you can go to college, you can be a civilian, and we'll pay for that college, and all you have to do is train 1 week in a month and 2 weeks out of the year, and you won't be going to war. If there's a natural disaster in Florida, which we have hurricanes in Florida, you'll be doing disaster relief. So I get out of the active duty, I go back to Florida, and I join the Florida National Guard, and I go back to going to the same community college, which was Miami-Dade Community College. Now it's a full-blown college, it's called Miami-Dade College. Back then it was still a community college. I complete my 2 years with the Florida National Guard, according to me paying for my tuition. And then because I wanted to pursue a degree in psychology, I wanted to go to a school that would allow me to do research and to get some clinical experience so that I could pursue a PhD in psychology. So I transferred to the University of Miami and I go back to my National Guard unit and I say, I transferred to the University of Miami, I need you to pay for my tuition. And they tell me, well, in reality, we don't pay for tuition. But the Florida National Guard has a deal with the state government to where soldiers don't have to pay tuition, they get tuition waived. But the moment you transfer to a private university, you're on your own. The other thing that I found out was that the moment that the military starts or stops waiving this tuition, I automatically owe the National Guard an extra 3 years. So if I come to the end of my eight-year military contract and I graduate from a public university with the Florida National Guard waiving my tuition, I find myself in a position where I have to serve an extra 3 years. So I decide to find help elsewhere and I apply for scholarships and I take out loans and I start financing my own tuition at the University of Miami. When I come to the end of my 8-year military contract in the year 2003, three months before the end of my 8-year military contract, and just one semester away from graduating from the University of Miami, we have a company formation, and our commander tells us, if you were about to get out of the military, you have been extended until the year 2031. So my military contract goes from being 3.5 years to being 8 years, possibly 11 years, to being extended until the year 2031. Now, somebody today pointed out that that's ridiculous, but it's in the orders. I have the orders, I have the paperwork to prove it. And it is ridiculous, it is absurd. But what this does, it gives the military the legal power to activate me beyond the end of my 8-year military contract for 2 years. And if they need me beyond those 2 years, they can activate me for another 2 years, and then another 2 years, all the way until the year 2031. If you ask any military attorney in the military or outside of the military who does military law, they will tell you that this document and this stop loss, which extends you to the year 2031, does give the military the power to continue extending you until the year 2031. So I get activated and I get extended to the year 2031. The promise of a college education, you know, getting there has to be put on standby, getting out of the military. This was January of 2003. I was supposed to get out in May of 2003. Now I get out in May of the year 2031. So getting out of the military, which I was really looking forward to, so I could go into a PhD program, everything completely crumbles. And at this point, I find myself being opposed to the war in Iraq politically. And I say politically because I wasn't really personally opposed to it. It didn't really mean much to me. At the time, I was going to a private university. I was living in a nice neighborhood in Florida. I was living my own life, almost completely independently from the military, looking towards the future. And the possibility of war in Iraq seemed distant. The war in Afghanistan was a war being fought a world away. Other people's pain, other people's suffering. But now suddenly this becomes my reality. It becomes a war that I'm going to have to fight. Not far away, not other people's war, not other people's suffering, but my war. And it affects me personally because I have to abandon my home, my school, my plans, my future, my ambitions. And I have to go back to the military to active duty, to go halfway across the world to fight a war that I don't believe in. But I'm telling myself, you sign a contract, you've been extended. You're supposed to keep your mouth shut and not question the orders of your commanders. And you're supposed to do your duty. And you're supposed to fight and follow your orders. And I'm too afraid to stand up and say, I think this war is wrong because I signed a contract. And because I'm supposed to fight and not question. And because if I say something, I may be construed as a traitor and a coward, and I may be tried by a court-martial and put in jail, and I didn't want to go to jail. And at the time, it didn't really make a whole lot of sense politically that there was going to be a war, because we had the United Nations saying that the UN Security Council was not approving this war. We had UN weapons inspectors saying, we don't think that there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. We had people like Mohammed Al-Baradei, we had people like Hans Blix saying, we need more time. We don't know that there are weapons of mass destruction here. And yet, we're still going. They're saying that there are connections between Saddam Hussein and 9/11, but none are found. And about 11 or 12 of the hijackers responsible for the 9/11 attacks are from Saudi Arabia. Not one of them is from Iraq. And yet we're going after Iraq. And North Korea is flaunting its weapons of mass destruction at the US with capabilities to reach the California coastline. And we're going against a country where the experts are saying that there are no weapons of mass destruction. Now, I'm not trying to make a case for war against North Korea or Saudi Arabia. I'm just saying that at the time, it just didn't make a whole lot of political sense. And part of me is saying, you sign a contract, you're supposed to keep your mouth shut, you're supposed to do what you're told. Maybe there won't be a war. Maybe it's just a huge arms buildup to scare Saddam out of power. And if you say anything, you'll be a traitor, you'll be tried for desertion, you'll be tried for disobedience, you'll be put in jail, and I'm terrified of all those things. And I keep telling myself, I have to push my principles aside and I have to do what I'm told. I'll put this behind when it's over. And I go to Iraq against my will, against my better judgment, against my conscience. And I find myself in Iraq. And the first mission we have is at this place called Al-Asad. Al-Asad is an old Iraqi Air Force base where they had these jet bunkers. And one of these jet bunkers had been turned into a prisoner of war camp, surrounded by concertina wire and being run by what is known in the military as spooks. And a spook basically is like a ghost soldier or a ghost agent. It could be CIA, it could be special operations, somebody who's highly trained but basically untraceable. Don't wear a name tag, don't wear a unit ID, don't wear uniforms, but they are highly trained and they are untraceable and they are in charge of this place. And they go by code names, and the ones that were in charge of Al-Asad POW camp, their names were Rabbit, Bear, and believe it or not, Scooter. So we go to this place, and the first thing they tell us is, don't call this place a POW camp. Because POW camps, prisoner of war camps, are supposed to follow certain guidelines. For instance, they're supposed to be run by military intelligence, soldiers, military police soldiers, military guards. There's supposed to be medical personnel on site. There's supposed to be a helicopter ready to evacuate in case a detainee is wounded or seriously ill, or a field line ambulance. There should be a medical facility around. There should be a number of things present that are not present that make the place illegal. So they tell us, it's not a prisoner of war camp. Don't call it that. It's a detention camp. So the very first thing that they tell us is, we have to cover our backs. Don't call this a POW camp. And I said, okay, so it's not a POW camp. It's a detention camp. So they tell us what's going on here is that we get detainees from the adjacent units who are patrolling the area and who are bringing these detainees, and what happens is that the spooks make an initial assessment and they determine who is or who isn't an enemy combatant. And our job is to keep the enemy combatants on sleep deprivation. So we go inside of this bunker, and they have an area where they have concertina wire around people who are barefooted, sitting on the concrete floor, tied and hooded. And we're supposed to keep him on sleep deprivation. When I ask what makes this person an enemy combatant, they tell me, well, the fact that he was caught with a weapon, with a rifle. And what was the context of his capture? And they say, well, he's a sheep herder and he needs a rifle to protect his sheep from thieves and from predators. But the fact that he had a rifle makes him an enemy combatant, and we're supposed to keep him in sleep deprivation. I point at somebody else and they say, well, they are enemy combatants because they were in possession of a wooden box that had explosives. And I said, what kind of explosives? We don't know, because the box was empty. Then why are they here? Well, because they had a box that had explosives sometime in the past. I said, okay, so how do we keep these people awake? How do we keep them sleep deprived? Well, basically, you yell at them. You get in their face and you tell them to get up, to get down, to put their arms up and out and down again, to turn around, to sit down. And I said, how do they understand? They don't speak English. They said, well, basically, like a dog. You yell at a dog enough times, the dog will get it. You tell a human being enough times to get up, he'll get the point and he'll get up. You tell a human being enough times to get down, he'll get the point and he'll get down. Just like an animal. Human beings are just like animals. Now, if that yelling doesn't work, then you grab a huge sledgehammer, and because of the type of structure that these bunkers are, when you hit the wall, there's such echo that it sounds like an explosion. And when you do it next to a person who's been awake for 2 days and who's hooded and tied, really tired, you make them think that they're about to get blown up, or they almost just got blown up, you scare them, and they do whatever you tell them to do. It doesn't matter how tired they are. If that doesn't work, then you take a pistol, a 9mm pistol, and you put it to the detainee's head, and you make the motion as though you're charging the weapon without putting a bullet in it, to make the detainee think that you're about to blow his brains out. And that scares them to the point where, regardless of how tired they are, they do anything you tell them to do. And if the gun does not work, you put them in a room that is narrow enough for a human being to stand in it, but not sit or lay down, so that they have to stand. And you bang the wall next to him to drive him crazy. In a way, I suppose, making an example out of the detainee so the others answer to the pistol and answer to the sledgehammer and answer to the yelling. And after you do this for a few hours, you let them sleep for 30 to 45 seconds. And when you do that and you let them sleep for 30 to 45 seconds, they don't know if they've been asleep for 2 hours or 2 days or 10 minutes, any notion of time or space that they may have had. You completely destroy it. You break them down psychologically, physically, emotionally, in order to soften them up and get them ready for interrogation. And this is the first mission that I have when I go to Iraq. So there starts to be a transformation, because no longer is it something just political that I am reading about in the newspapers, but it's something that I am actually doing myself. It's not that I am reading about abuse, it's not that I am witnessing abuse, but that I myself, I am abusing people. And I become that abuse. Not just the abuser, the abuse, I become it. And it changes me profoundly inside. But I'm still too afraid to do or say anything about it, because I signed a contract. And because I am in the military, and because I'm supposed to do everything I'm told. And I'm not supposed to think for myself, and I'm not supposed to question. I'm just supposed to do what everybody else is doing and keep my mouth shut. And doing anything otherwise than that could mean that you could be court-martialed, or that you could be called a coward or a traitor, or you could go to jail, or a number of things could happen to you. And I'm too afraid, and I keep doing it. And then go to this place. We go to this place called Ar-Ramadi, which was a Sunni city in Iraq, part of the Sunni triangle. Before we went to Iraq, our commanders had told us that we were not to go back. We were not to come back from the Middle East without our CAB. And the CAB is the Combat Infantry Badge. The Combat Infantry Badge is a badge in the Army that infantrymen and special operations soldiers get after they have engaged the enemy in direct combat. Without engaging the enemy, you cannot get this award, which is a combat award, given only to the infantry or special ops. So what happens is that we have a lot of commanders in our unit who have been in the military 15, 20, 25 years and have no combat experience. And they have ambitions and want to get promoted. They want to advance their careers in the military, but they don't have the combat experience that they need. They need that combat glory. They need those medals. They need the CAB. So when we get to the city and we start encountering resistance, we make the resistance worse by doing everything opposite from how we should be doing things. For instance, as infantrymen, we're supposed to follow no patterns. We're supposed to make ourselves unpredictable, use the element of surprise, not do the same missions over and over in the same exact way, day after day. And this is exactly what we're doing. We're exposing ourselves to instigate firefights. And we are infuriating people by conducting missions on places where we know we're not supposed to conduct missions. For instance, next to mosques, next to schools, busy traffic intersections, all the places that we should stay away from, we're conducting all these missions. And there start to be firefights. And people begin to die, soldiers begin while soldiers around the areas began to die, nobody in my unit died. But we took some pretty heavy casualties. We had people who lost limbs. We have a person who right now has to live with shrapnel through his skull. If they pull it out, he dies, can't recognize family members. And this is all because we're doing everything the opposite way, because we have commanders behind us pushing us and instigating firefights, exposing us to unnecessary danger so that they can make their medals to advance our careers. My unit alone, up until October of 2003, had killed 33 people in our Ramadi. Of those 33 people, only 3 had weapons. Everybody else was caught in the wrong place and at the wrong time. And nobody is saying or doing anything about it. Everybody's going along with the flow, and everybody's keeping their mouth shut. And we continue to push our principles aside and not do anything about illegal orders and killings of civilians, in part because we're afraid to stand up to authority, and in part because we're too concerned with our own survival. Because in an environment like this, surviving becomes the number one priority. You're afraid, you're frustrated, you want to get home alive and in one piece. So you shoot back with everything you have. And the people who pay the price are the innocent civilians. So then there's another transition in my personal journey, because not only is it that I go from being politically opposed to the war to being more personally and more morally opposed to the war, but now I am opposed not just to the war in Iraq, but to all war. Because I realized that the evil of war has nothing to do with politics. So the conversion here is that I no longer oppose just the war in Iraq, but all war. But it's too difficult to make a decision being in Iraq, because you're being shot at every moment of your life, and because the war is being fought everywhere. There's no such thing as the trenches or the front lines. Everywhere you go, there could be a bomb waiting for you, ready to explode and kill you. On your base, you get attacked with mortars. You can get ambushed anytime. So you continue to push your principles aside in order to survive, and because you're too afraid to stand up to authority. Then I come back to the United States on a 2-week furlough, and people start asking me questions. Friends who were in the military in the past began asking me questions about the glory of war. People who used to be in the infantry, people who used to be in the Marines, people who got out before going to war, and are really gung-ho and happy to know that I have been in combat. How was it? Tell me about the firefights, tell me about the ambush, tell me about this, tell me about that. And I start telling them the stories. And in telling them the stories, I start reliving the experiences, the firefights, the raids, the curfews, going back to the killings, going back to civilians being killed, to soldiers losing limbs, to us being used as bait, nobody doing anything about it. And for the first time, I'm not under threat. And I'm not too concerned with surviving, because I am outside of that combat context. And then I start asking questions to myself. Why did you do it? Going back to the killings, trying to find justification. And I find nothing. And I come up empty. Weapons of mass destruction? None. Links between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda? None. Chemical weapons? The first thing they told us to put away when we got to Iraq was our chemical mask. So they knew they didn't have chemical weapons. And then I started telling myself, well, I have to go back because I signed a contract, and because we're fighting for one another, and because I'm not supposed to question the war, and because I'm not supposed to think for myself, but do what I'm told and keep my mouth shut. But then the images keep coming back about the people who were killed, the innocent civilians who were killed, the soldiers who were losing legs, and nobody is doing or saying anything. And when it comes time to return to Iraq, I don't decide not to go back, but I simply don't get on the plane. And I keep telling myself, you have to go back, you have to go back. You sign a contract, it's your military duty. And I keep telling myself, no, I can't do that. But then doubts come back. You have to do it, you have to get back. Maybe the next day, and then maybe the next day. Until one day I realized that I wasn't going back. but it wasn't a decision that I really took. You know, there wasn't a moment when I said, I'm not going back. It's probably the most difficult process I've gone through in my life, to decide not to go back to Iraq. And I started seeking legal help, and I found an attorney here in Massachusetts, out of Brookline, himself a war resister from the war in Vietnam, a conscientious objector. His name is Louis Font. But I continued to be afraid, and I continued to fear for my own personal safety and about the fact that I'm going to be called a traitor, and that I could be tried by a court-martial, and that desertion in the time of war could be punishable by death, or I could end up in jail many years. And I'm really afraid. And I start seeking spiritual counseling, and I end up in this place called the Peace Abbey in Sherbourne, Massachusetts. At the Peace Abbey, they have monuments that they dedicate to unknown civilians killed in war. They have pictures of children who are victims of mines, who have no limbs, children being born with depleted uranium contamination deformity, and just basically the cost that humanity has paid for war throughout history. And I realized that my sacrifice, that going to jail, the sacrifice that implies to go to jail, is nothing compared to the sacrifices of other people. And it humbles me and it gives me strength. So I surrendered to the military, but I don't go in quietly. I give a press conference, and I say that I was in Iraq and that I'm not returning because it's an illegal war, criminal, immoral, and that we're killing innocent civilians, and that we're fighting for oil, and that I'm not a mercenary, and that I don't have to fight this war, and that no serviceman or woman should have to fight this illegal criminal war. I'm a conscientious objector, and I'm not going back. And having said that, I surrendered to the nearest military base, which was an Air Force base in Lexington, Massachusetts, called Hanscom Air Force Base. And for the first time during this war and during this time, the military is faced with dissent, with public dissent within the ranks. One of their own is coming forward and saying publicly that we are committing crimes, that this is an illegal war, that I am a conscientious objector, and that I'm not going back. And it becomes a political case, because it becomes a political question to the military as to how are you going to deal with dissent within your own ranks. Are you going to allow this man to be discharged from the military as a conscientious objector? Are you going to listen to his claims that we're committing atrocities in Iraq? Or are you going to make an example out of him and put him in jail? Because my trial was very political, and they were really afraid of the message, and they were really afraid of the support that I received from people, that the day of my trial, they restricted the entry through the main gate to the base to only military personnel, my attorneys, and a few members of my family. Everybody else was directed to gate number 3, which was miles away, and they took down the signs so that people would get lost and that they couldn't go into the base to support me. They barricaded the entire block of the courthouse. They designated a media center for reporters who went there to cover the news, which was about a mile away from the courthouse. They confiscated cameras, recording devices, computers, and they only let in a few reporters. They detailed soldiers to fill up half of the courthouse so that there would be less room for people who had shown up to support me. They have working dogs sniffing around the courthouse. Certainly when I saw that, I thought they had caught Osama bin Laden and they were going to try him. And I said, I remember saying that I'm a pacifist. But they were so afraid of the support that I was receiving that they did everything within their power to keep that support away, because they knew that a lot of people stood behind me and they knew that it was a political case. So they answered the political question of dissent within the ranks by throwing the book at me, finding me guilty of desertion with the intent to avoid hazardous duty, demoting me from the staff from staff sergeant to private, forfeiture of 2/3 of my pay, a bad conduct discharge, and 12 months of confinement in a military prison. About 10 days after my conviction, I was adopted by Amnesty International as a prisoner of conscience, and I received tons of letters from people all over the United States and the world, people who reaffirmed to me that I had made the right decision, and that the world stood behind me against the war and for peace. And even though I was behind bars, I felt free because I had followed my conscience, and I felt connected to humanity because of all the support that I received from people all over the world. And I had no regrets. I got out in February of this year, and I became a member of an organization called Iraq Veterans Against the War. And I have been touring the country, sharing my experience with people. And I'm a peace activist, and I'm going to continue to be a peace activist until the day that I die. And I thank you for listening and for letting me share my experience with you.
That has been Camilo Mejia, GI resistor, conscientious objector, and Iraq war veteran, speaking on December 7th in Lawrence, Mass. We will return to his presentation and question and answer period after a short break with announcements and more.
To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.